Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, with T derailments and impossible traffic, are we ready for another disruption? Major work on the Pike?
The Turnpike, right, which today is a parking lot at peak. If there's something worse than a parking lot, it's going to become that pretty soon.
Also today, Ohio Congressman Tim Ryan says that as president, he'd represent the working class.
And then you represent a factory like General Motors, and you see General Motors gets a bailout, General Motors gets a tax cut. My people get the shaft.
And
roll out those lazy
actress and singer Jane Lynch performs the American Songbook with the Boston Pops.
There's kind of a satisfying simplicity with a well-formed pop song.
That's all next on WBUR's Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Let's begin today with an increasingly urgent question. How do you get around in Greater Boston? Today, the MBTA suspended red line service between JFK, UMass, and North Quincy stations, replaced by shuttle buses. The trains are now running again, for those of you thinking about your afternoon commute. Yesterday's red line derailment left one person injured and damaged signal bungalows, which now need to be replaced. Traffic backed up on the roads, and lift prices from JFK, UMass station to downtown Boston spiked as high as $123. Our first guests today warn us that it is going to get worse before it gets better. Jim Aloisi is a former state transportation secretary and Mass Turnpike Board chairman. He's now a member of the Transit Matters Board and the principal of TriMount Consulting. Welcome back to Radio Boston, Jim.
Thank you for having me back.
Great to have you. And Mary Connaughton is the director of government transparency at the Pioneer Institute. And she served on the Mass Turnpike Authority Board from 2005 to 2009. Welcome back to you as well, Mary.
Thank you, Tiziana.
Now, we have a lot to talk about, but first, listeners. In a recent Boston Globe op-ed, Jim and Mary warned of the coming disruption from two major projects on the Mass Pike starting this summer. Work in the Prudential Tunnel, and then a decade-long project on the BU section of the Pike. Did you know this was coming? Are we ready? How do you plan for your commute? Are you fed up with the state of our transportation system? Give us a ring. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or you can tweet at us at Radio Boston. All right, so Jim and Mary, I want to start with what might seem like a basic question. We know we have terrible traffic in Boston. Some of the worst in the country, or actually the worst by one report. Why are we doing this to ourselves? Why this massive project?
Well, the Alston project is a safety project. Anyone who drives on the turnpike there may not realize it, but they're on, when it's around here, when it's around Boston University, it's elevated. It's on a viaduct.
Mm-hmm.
That viaduct is the same viaduct that was originally built back in the 60s.
And so a viaduct is like a street
on
stilts,
elevated,
right?
It's an elevated portion, correct.
Okay.
And so it needs to be replaced for safety reasons. But
Okay. That's
the key thing to point out. This is a safety project. This is not a capacity-growing project. So
Okay. The
capacity of the turnpike will not expand after this project is completed. And so what Mary and I are recognizing and hoping other people recognize is that the combination of this very disruptive but necessary construction work,
okay,
plus some private sector air rights development, which
mm-hmm.
is happening soon, are going to combine over the next decade and maybe more to completely disrupt traffic on the turnpike. Now, some people may say it's already disrupted. It's already at peak. The turnpike is already a parking lot.
Yeah.
So whatever the word is that's worse than a parking lot is what the turnpike
that.
Will be.
Okay.
And what
okay.
we're saying very clearly is that the state needs to commit to a vibrant rail solution
mm-hmm.
and a bus solution, but more importantly, from my perspective, keeping the Worcester rail line running frequently all day long.
Yeah.
And that means keeping two tracks open at all times.
Okay. So I want to get back to your prescriptions. But before we do that, Mary, I want to ask you, can you just tell people what's going to happen? What are we going to be doing?
Sure. So as Jim said, the number one thing that they'll be doing is removing that viaduct by BU.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to straighten out the turnpike there. If you think about it, it's a big, huge curve that goes by through Alston by the Charles.
Okay.
So they're going to straighten it out over the rail yards there and then maintain it at close to at grade level. Additionally, Soldiers Field Road is going to go up. It's to be elevated, so that's another creation of mm-hmm. a viaduct. And they're also going to improve the Paul Dudley White bike path there.
Okay.
So, and to do that, the plan is to reduce the number of lanes available on the turnpike from that area, which is 4 to 3, both
okay.
eastbound, westbound, 24/7.
So that's 2 lanes total. One.
Right.
Okay.
It means speed reduction because of work zones, mm-hmm. people working. And as Jim said, one of the things that would be disastrous is if they actually, in that area of construction, take the Worcester line from 2 tracks to 1 track. So an inbound train has to wait for an outbound train to come out. That would be a huge bottleneck. And that's something that the MBTA just corrected, because that was an issue several years ago. And I take that rail every day
mm-hmm.
and notice vast improvement.
Okay.
So going backwards at
Doesn't
this time,
good.
Especially, and as Jim mentioned, with the mass congestion that will be coming, now's a great time to get people addicted to the commuter rail. I mean, avoid congestion, avoid sitting in traffic. Commuter rail will have a better schedule, get people to work, get people home to their kids,
yeah.
and get them hooked on it now.
Okay, so we're already stressing out callers. Galen from Newton has called to share thoughts on this. Galen, welcome to Radio Boston. Jump on in. Tell us
Thank
what you're
so
calling
much for.
For
taking my call. Thank you very much. So I live in Newton Corner, right off the pike on exit 17.
Mm-hmm.
And every day, taking the express bus, no matter where you take it from downtown, it's about a mile, at least a mile, every single evening from like 4-6, no matter how you time it, backed up on the pike just to get to that exit, cars getting on and off. And I'm wondering, I mean, what is the solution going to be for people who live in the outer areas where the T doesn't go and where if you don't take an express bus, it's about, I don't know, an hour plus taking, say, the Red Line to a regular bus service out of, I don't know, Harvard Square or something like that to get to Newton, Waltham, et cetera.
Is it Galen? Is that
Galen?
Galen.
Yep.
So, Galen, I think there's two answers to your question. First of all, you're right in pointing out that a bus stuck in traffic isn't a real solution. If we can get to the Worcester line and if you can get to commuter rail, the first step, we think, is getting more frequent, you know, all-day service on commuter rail. And there are 3 stations in Newton. I don't know if you're close to any, but that's the first necessary solution. Have frequent all-day service. Stop holding trains. We have trains sitting idle all day long at Alston. We need to keep those trains operating all day so that you have frequent service all day. Second, bus dedicated lanes or bus priority lanes, I think, are also an essential ingredient to the solution so that, as you know, every bus is carrying many, many more people than several cars with just one person driving. And so in a situation like this, one of the things I think the state needs to do and the city to cooperate with them is to dedicate priority lanes for buses, especially during peak hours. And that's the way we're going to move more people. The Governor's Commission on the Future of Transportation talked about moving more people and not vehicles. This project is going to be a great testing bed for that principle.
So, listeners, I just want to come back to you. We want to hear from you. So call in. What are your concerns? What are your challenges in your commute today? What questions do you have for our guests? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Now, Mary, Jim just said, you know, move more people without moving more cars. You said you want to get people addicted to the commuter rail right now. Okay. But is the commuter rail ready to take a whole new passel of addicts? I mean, can we take the additional capacity?
Well, it has to get more equipment to be able to service the number of people that should migrate to it. But over the past few years, there have been tremendous improvements along the Worcester Line. They've replaced a lot of track. There used to be speed reductions on really hot days in the summer because the tracks would, like, expand, and it was too the commuter rail couldn't go that fast.
Mm-hmm.
So they've replaced about, I think, over 100,000 feet of track. They've also replaced the boards below the track. They've done work on the signalization. They've done work on getting more parking along the Worcester Line. So there have been great improvements, upgraded the signalization, I should say.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're moving in the right direction, but they just don't have enough equipment to accommodate the amount of people that should come on. Additionally, they have to be able to work on a system that will allow them to get more trains on the track at a single time. But the lead time for locomotive equipment or cars right now is about 8 to 10 years. So unless they are really think about leasing equipment or doing something really innovative, that will be really hard to implement.
Yeah,
but
I mean,
now
how
is the time.
Isn't that just a total non-starter if it's going to take 8 to 10 years?
No. It won't take 8 to 10 years to improve. Look, Transit Matters looked at this thing. With the current equipment, if it's not being laid over all day, you can get at least off-peak hourly service.
So you can make better use of our current
equipment. Right. Hourly service is in 15-minute service. I get that. But it's hourly service all day long, off-peak.
Mm-hmm.
And then you gradually begin to transition to improve that. We got to start somewhere.
Okay.
But I think what we're saying is let's start where we can start. We can start at that point, and we can improve it by doing a variety of things, buying the new equipment, but also doing things like building high-level platforms at every station so that people can board trains more quickly and their dwell times are less, and it'll speed up the trip and the frequencies.
So we're talking a lot about rail here, but what started this conversation is the fact that we're going to do some road work. So this is the whole body of transportation infrastructure in Greater Boston. Mary, you talked about the heat and the tracks expanding and contracting. We're not really known for mild weather in Boston.
Right.
And it feels like we're kind of hitting this crisis point of wear and tear in our infrastructure. So I think one thing we kind of want to know is just how bad is it?
Well, the average lifespan of a bridge is about 70 years. And when you think about when all the highways were built in this country, they're butting up against that timeline. So there's a lot of work that needs to be done. A lot of work has been done on improving the bridges in the state and across the country, but there's still a lot more to go.
Mm-hmm.
As far as the roadways go, they're narrow. There's not a lot of room on the turnpike to expand. There's not a lot of give. And as Galen had mentioned, there's bottlenecks. Newton Corner is an enormous bottleneck, east, west. Almost any time of day, it causes backups. But there's other bottlenecks along the turnpike that it'd be really tricky to try to fix. But as Jim said, if more people could get into buses, if they used park and rides out in the suburbs and had commuter buses that people can use, just pick them up there. If they got more parking at the commuter rail station, because that's another bottleneck. If they can't park there, they could partner with private entities to lease out spaces. But the Framingham lot's pretty much full by 7:15. If you look at all inward, it's about the same time. Some lots are full a lot earlier than that.
Yeah.
So we have to think about how we can make it more convenient for people to use commuter rail and get them off the road during this time of construction, because what will happen is the turnpike gets congested.
Mm-hmm.
People use Waze or other devices to figure out ways around the traffic, but then all the side streets back up.
Yeah.
And then there's congestion everywhere. And what does that do to the environment?
That's right. So listen, our lines are backed up. So I want to get a couple of callers in. Let's take two. Let's listen to Tony from Bourne. Tony, what's on your mind?
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. Great to listen to the show. I am a commuter. I work at Logan Airport in Boston, and I live in Bourne. So there are a few ways I can commute. One of the ways is a commuter rail, but I think the biggest prohibition isn't so much service, it's the price. They just increased the fee of a monthly pass to about $426 a month, in addition to paying for parking at the rail center. And it's cheaper for me to drive my plug-in hybrid and park in Boston than it is to take the commuter rail. So why would I add? The commute does add an extra hour to my commute each way. So I think you know, they need to work on price, first of all, and maybe even if you work on the rail in the stations, like Boston, in my opinion, should be free, because then if you're not paying for employees, you could take the rail free, and it would increase ridership and save the money on the roads.
Tony, thanks for your call. So Tony's feeling the pinch of price. Let's hear what's on Melissa's mind from Ashland. Melissa, what made you call in?
Well, I really feel like no one's considering the helplessness of the consumer. And that would be, you know, all of us commuting, sitting there for hours. And yet the MBTA has the gall to go ahead and do these construction projects and doesn't consider anything that the residences of the area are going through. You know, I hear these wonderful consultants talk about the need for, you know, these kinds of platforms or additional trains, but yet they go ahead with this huge construction on the Pike and expect us to sit there for 2 or 3 hours. It's unacceptable to not consider the residences of Boston before undergoing these huge projects.
Melissa, thanks for your call. So, Jim, we heard two kinds of frustrations there. There's the price frustration, and there's that helplessness of sitting, you know, sitting there and not being able to get anywhere.
Let me respond to the last caller first, which is to say, look, first of all, this is not the MBTA doing this project. This is the Mass Highway Department. And it's, as I said earlier, it's a public safety project. And so it's simply not the kind of project that you can continually defer. You could criticize how long it takes us to get things done. You know, lots of ways to look at this. But no one doubts the necessity to do this from a public safety perspective. So that's the first thing. No one in their right mind in public service tries, you know, deliberately to inconvenience people just for the fun of it, right? There's a reason for it, number one. In terms of the gentleman from Bourne, he's right. The fare hike is too high when you're coming from the far reaches of the MBTA commuter rail system. We believe that sincerely. One of the things that we hope will happen sometime soon, with the introduction of the new fare collection, what's called AFC2, which has now been delayed, unfortunately, would be a rationalization of commuter rail fares so that it cannot be correct.
Rationalization, right? Meaning?
Meaning you have to make them fairer for everybody and to create a fare structure so that it is not true that it's cheaper to drive and park than take commuter rail, right?
Okay.
If we're going to have a sustainable mobility system, then that cannot be the right equation. We've got to make sure that those commuter rail fares are lower than the cost of driving and parking, even if that means that they're being subsidized, because there's a policy behind doing that.
Okay. Right? Now, I want to get to another caller in just a second. And Mary, I know you had something you wanted to say there, but I want you to say something else instead.
Okay. You got it.
You talked, you know, we're talking about this and the things that we need to do. And Mary, you said, hey, it's been 70 years, right? Mm-hmm. Well, shouldn't we have invested sooner then? I mean, why are we now at this point of kind of crazy safety crisis? Where was the investment along the way?
That's a really good question.
They've been
looking at deferred maintenance on so many of our transportation systems for years. I think in 2006 or 2007, the Transportation Finance Commission came up with a number of like 7 or 20 billion. What was the number in terms of the backlog of
20?
20 billion in terms of backlog and maintenance. So people have been looking at it. They know it's there. But until it becomes crisis, it's hard to get the budgeting done, get the effort put towards it. But they have been making improvements. It's not like it's been totally neglected, but there's been parts of the T that have been neglected. There's an issue with the T is that they have the funding for a lot of the capital projects that need to be done, but getting the expertise in to get those projects completed has been an issue over the years.
Yeah.
They're making some headway there, but not as much as we would like to make sure that things like what happened over the past few days don't happen again.
With these derailments, the red line derailment and then the green line derailment on Saturday. Let's listen to Ankita, and if I pronounce that wrong, I apologize. Ankita from Cambridge.
Hi. No, you pronounced it correctly. So I am a commuter. I commute by car right now from Central Square in Cambridge to the Seaport, which is about a 4-mile drive that usually takes me about 20 minutes. And I used to take the red line or bike in, but because of the unpredictability of the red line, which could take me anywhere from 40 minutes to an hour 15, I chose to drive. And that's largely because even though traffic can be really unpredictable, it's generally faster. And I can take conference calls or dial into meetings if I'm running late from my car, which I can't do on public transportation or while underground. So I think there's some level of sort of reliability, but also just convenience about being able to drive that I personally find ridiculous that I have to do. But it's the way that I can sort of balance my work and my life and commuting together.
All right, Jim. Jim wants to respond to you, Ankita.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah. Ankita, are you still there?
Yeah, I'm okay. Here.
Hi, Ankita. Can I ask you a question? Do you have a place to park, and does that cost you money?
It does. So I work in 121 Seaport. We have garage parking underneath. The company subsidizes 3/4 of it, so I pay $100 a month for parking.
All right. So that's part of the answer here to you. I'm wondering why you would not take transit from Central Square. And it highlights an issue, which is the availability of low-cost parking, right? A car is useless to everybody. A car is useless to you mm-hmm. unless you have a place to put it. And so one of the things we need to be thinking about in Massachusetts, especially in inner core communities, is the cost of parking. And
you saying you want to make parking more expensive?
I do. I want to make parking more expensive because I want to charge people for their impacts on traffic congestion and their impacts on air quality
okay.
and their impacts on quality of life. And I think we would use that money to improve public transportation and complete streets. We've got to face up to the reality that the ways we've been approaching mobility, the sort of mid-20th century auto-centric approaches to mobility, mm-hmm. don't respond to our needs or even, frankly, our values in the 21st century. And so the idea that parking is available and subsidized and free may be personally convenient, but it really doesn't help build the kind of sustainable mobility system that I think we all aspire to.
Okay, that's helpful. So we've got about a minute or so left. And what I want to do is, there is, again, I said this on our tea conversation yesterday, there is no single magic bullet. But we are here. This is where we are. We got to live with what's coming. So what's the most important next investment? And I'd love to hear from Mary first and then also you, Jim.
Well, I think a mitigation plan that's really transparent, bought off by signed off by MassDOT and the MBTA for these mega projects that are coming up mm-hmm. really needs to happen so people know what they're in for and what the mitigation is going to be, and perhaps go to the federal government rather than to the toll payers to fund some of this stuff. It's been on the toll payers' backs for far too long.
Mm-hmm.
And just trying to make sure that people know what is being done and not leave them in the dark. I mean, so many people, I live in Metro West, I'm a Framingham resident, so I take the Western Line all the time.
Yeah.
I talk to people at the baseball games and they have no idea that this is coming. So transparency, getting it out there, having some more public meetings so people can get involved in the planning process of this, because they are the ones, like the woman from Ashland, that are really going to be impacted and deserve a seat at the table.
Okay, Jim, and quick comment from you.
So I agree with Mary. We need a strong mitigation package for the Worcester Line during construction on Alston. We also need, on the larger scale, I believe we need net new revenue so okay. we can accelerate state of good repair and modernization work, and so we can complete some critical transit completion and connectivity projects. That would include connecting the Blue Line to the Red Line. It includes an early build West Station here mm-hmm. At Alston mm-hmm. Landing to facilitate those rail moves. And ultimately, it involves investing in a new, more robust intercity rail, regional rail system that's electrified, that's quick, that's fast, and that is the antidote to congestion on the roadways.
Okay, so transparency, strategy, and net new revenue. Jim Aloisi is a former state transportation secretary and Mass Turnpike board chairman. He's now a member of the Transit Matters Board and the principal of Trimont Consulting. Thanks for coming in, Jim.
Thanks again.
And Mary Connaughton, she's the director of government transparency at the Pioneer Institute and served on the Mass Turnpike Authority Board from 2005 to 2009. Thanks to you too, Mary.
Wonderful to be here, Tiziana.
Listeners, you can find a link to their op-ed on our website, RadioBoston.org. Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Tiziana Deering, and this is Radio Boston.
Wait a second.
Don't hit the skip button.
I mean, we know you do it.
We just wanted to take a second here because you already know how to download a podcast.
But you might have a question about some of the other technology you use, and we think we can help.
WBUR is working on a new show, and we're here to answer your tech questions, whether it's hardware-related,
software-related, social, even ethical.
Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and give us a call. Leave a message, 617-917-4717.
Give it a try, 617-917-4717.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Jane Lynch is a comedian, singer, and an Emmy Award-winning actress. She's best known for portraying Sue Sylvester, the ruthless cheerleading coach on Fox's musical TV show Glee.
I know my methods are extreme. I know I'm not like the rest of you hippies, caring about the kids' feelings as if they're real.
You may also know her from films like Best in Show and The 40-Year-Old Virgin. She's a self-taught singer, touring a cabaret show across the country in 2015. And this week, she is performing her favorite songs from the American Songbook with the Boston Pops and her musical collaborator, Brad Ellis. He's a Berkeley alum who also starred as Glee's piano player. Radio Boston's Zoe Mitchell met up with Jane Lynch at Symphony Hall, where Lynch explained how she first got into singing.
Well, I am the daughter of Frank Lynch, Frank and Eileen Lynch, and we are a singing family. And my parents loved to sing, and they loved to harmonize. And I grew up with music. My father always had a song in his heart, on his lips, and he sang all day long around the house, and I do that myself. Anybody who spends 5 minutes with me would know that that's who I am. I've always loved doing performing, and it's only in the last 6 or 7 years that I've been doing it like on a touring basis.
Did the Boston Pops approach you about this performance, or how did this
come
together?
No, I approached them, my agent, you know, to be specific, but yeah, I wanted to perform here. I remember the Pops from when I was growing up. I remember watching Arthur Fiedler on television, and it always looked like so much fun, the 4th of July celebrations. It's Americana, and I love it.
Yeah, and I'd love to hear, I feel like so many people have done their own renditions. Like, mm-hmm. There's Rod Stewart, Lady Gaga, mm-hmm. I feel like is a recent one, Aretha Franklin. You know, what does a Jane Lynch, Brad Ellis interpretation sound like? How do you even start to develop that?
Well, Brad has his own style, but it's also respectful of every style of music there is, because he has mastered every style of music there is. So we combine styles sometimes in different songs. We're doing this song called Boo Hoo, which is from Guy Lombardo, who I know is a Canadian. Don't pick nuts with me. And Brad has kind of taken it from kind of the traditional bum, bum, ba-da-dum, bum, bum, ba-dum, and taken it kind of into a ballad for a little ways there. And we do a medley of, we call smoky, sad songs. And, it's kind of a depressing medley of love gone wrong. We kind of stay true to the style there, but you really see when you hear all of these songs together how sad and emotionally draining they can be.
Can you tell me, and obviously we don't want to reveal every single song in the show, but are there any that have a particular significance to you that you're performing tonight, or any reason you chose any of these?
I open with Lazy, Hazy, Crazy Days of Summer, which was a Nat King Cole hit in 1963, and it may be perhaps my first musical memory. It was a favorite song of my father's, and we loved summer growing up. Like in the 60s, summer was all about going on vacation with the family, loading up the station wagon and singing and, you know, going to the beach. And that's a song that celebrates that very American thing that I don't know that folks do anymore. Maybe they do. I don't know, but I just love that about the summer.
Roll out those lazy, hazy, crazy days of summer. Those days of sodas and pretzels and beer. Roll out.
And also the Boo Hoo, which is a song that I don't even know that my parents knew I was aware of.
Boo Hoo, that's why I'm crying.
I listened to it on a 78 in my grandmother's, on her old Victrola record player. And I would play it over and over again. I thought it was a wonderful song when I was a kid. And then I also do this song called A Letter from Camp. It's an Alan Sherman song, and it's really hilarious. And it's, hello, Mutta, hello, Fada, here I am at Camp Granada. And I remember loving that song when I was growing up.
What did you love about it?
Yeah, it rhymed, and it was funny, and it was about a kid who was at camp who just wanted to go home. He hated it.
Darling Fada, lovely mother, how's my precious little brother? Let me come home if you miss me. I will even let Aunt Bertha hug and kiss me.
you know, one thing I wanted to ask you about, I also am a fan of a lot of these songs. I'm a big musical person, Pence, Glee, et cetera. What do you think it is about these American songs that make them so kind of timeless? Like, they never feel like they go out of style. They always feel new.
Yeah, they're musically very simple. And they're melody driven, and they're written to a basic formula, and they're very satisfying. I'm going to sound like an old lady now, kids these days, but there's kind of a satisfying simplicity with a well-formed pop song that follows a particular recipe. There's beautiful rhymes, and the lyrics in some of the songs I'm singing are like poetry. That's what I love about it, and that's why I think these songs will endure.
I'd love to ask you, you mentioned your connection to this music started with your family, and I was reading some of the songs tonight are definitely a tribute to your father. You mentioned Hazy Crazy Days of Summer. You know, what do you think it would mean to him that you're doing this here?
Oh, I was just saying that out there. It's just, he would be thrilled to death. He would die all over again. he would just love this show. And I say in the beginning, this is basically a show inspired by my father. I found that the music that was first and foremost in my mind when I thought of what would I like to perform was all the stuff my dad used to sing around the house. And he would just love it. My mother, who is also not with us anymore, would love it too. I'm from a family of they came together on music, my mom and dad. They're not professional, but they would sing in the bars in Chicago. They met in a bar on the south side of Chicago, and they knew all the pop songs, and they harmonized. My dad had a beautiful tenor. And I remember my mother, toward the end of her life, she had a carotid artery, and they nicked her vocal cord, and she couldn't sing anymore. And that depressed her more than anything. And I was always so sad for her, 'cause she loved to sing in church, and now she had to switch octaves all the time, and it upset her greatly not to be able to sing.
That's singer, comedian, and actress Jane Lynch speaking with Radio Boston's Zoe Mitchell, who joins me now in the studio. Hi, Zoe.
Hello.
Zoe, it is great to hear about her connection with the American Songbook and hear those tunes, but Jane Lynch has had a pretty varied career, hasn't she?
Yeah, definitely, yeah. Yeah. She's done tons.
Yeah, and a wide variety of film, movie, television, et cetera.
Yeah, and so she was most recently, too, on this episode of Arthur last month, PBS's Arthur. There was an episode where there was a same-sex wedding ceremony, which kind of was a big deal. And in it, Arthur's teacher, Mr. Ratburn, marries an aardvark named Patrick. His students all attend. And Jane Lynch got to voice his sister, who performed the ceremony. And this episode was this quiet nod to the LGBTQ community. And I got to ask her about what it really meant for her to be a part of that.
So I think it was really lovely how they did it. I thought it was touching, and the wedding was so great with the kids, and I think it was just a lovely thing. It wasn't waving gay pride banners or anything like that. It was very quiet and simple and quite normal in the context in which it was presented. It's just, oh, isn't that wonderful? He found love.
Finally, you know, you've obviously had this long career. You've done a lot of different things, comedy, music, acting, performing. What would be your advice to young performers of any kind?
Just do what makes you feel good. You know, I never set out to be a singer or someone who does symphony shows. I didn't set out to even do like television. I really just wanted the opportunity to be on stage. And I couldn't have designed my career. I mean, my expectations for it would have fallen far below what actually happened. But I just really show up, and I say yes to just about everything, and except porn. And no one's asked me to do porn yet. But, you know, the answer will be no. I just want to get that out there right now. The answer will be no. Yeah, I just basically did anything that felt good. And singing felt really right and great in the last couple of years.
King of the road.
That's comedian, actress, and singer Jane Lynch speaking with Radio Boston's Zoe Mitchell. Zoe, thanks for that delightful conversation.
Thank you.
Jane Lynch will be performing again with the Boston Pops tonight. More information is on our website, radioboston.org. Stay with us. Coming up, we talk to Democratic presidential candidate Tim Ryan. I'm Tiziana Deering, and this is Radio Boston.
Wait a second.
Don't hit the skip button.
I mean, we know you do it.
We just wanted to take a second here because you already know how to download a podcast.
But you might have a question about some of the other technology you use, and we think we can help.
WBUR is working on a new show, and we're here to answer your tech questions, whether it's hardware-related,
software-related, social, even ethical.
Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and give us a call. Leave a message, 617-917-4717.
Give it a try, 617-917-4717.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Today we continue our series of conversations with Democrats running for president in 2020. Ohio Congressman Tim Ryan was elected in 2002 when he was 29 years old, at the time the youngest Democrat in the House. He came to national attention in 2016 when he tried to unseat Nancy Pelosi, arguing leadership had cost them elections in key Democratic strongholds in the Rust Belt. Congressman Ryan is now running for president to represent America's forgotten communities. Here he is speaking at Politics and Eggs Breakfast at San Anselm College in New Hampshire yesterday morning.
When you see the concentration of not just wealth, but of opportunity, and then you represent a factory like General Motors, and you see General Motors gets a bailout, General Motors gets a tax cut, my people get the shaft.
He joins us from Washington now, Congressman Ryan. Thanks so much for being with us on Radio Boston.
Thank you for having me.
Listeners, we want to hear from you. Do you have a question for Congressman Tim Ryan? What issues are most important to you going into the 2020 election? Please give us a call. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK or tweet us at Radio Boston. Congressman, let's start with the key question. Why are you running for president?
To represent those working class people that have been forgotten, those communities that have been forgotten. There's a concentration of wealth in the country. There's a concentration of opportunity. The wealthy get a tax cut. The wealthiest people in the country and the corporations get a bailout, and the average person is struggling to even make ends meet. You see the people, from my perception in Ohio, you see people on the coasts that buy their kids in the schools and the elite colleges and the Ivy Leagues, and it's not working anymore for the vast majority of the people, and I want to make sure that they have a voice and we start running this economy based on helping those people that are doing everything right.
So you're really speaking to the kind of the forgotten people in America, but it is a crowded Democratic field. What do you think most makes you different?
I live in this community. I live in a forgotten community. I grew up in a forgotten community. I could tell you stories from 40 years ago of my father-in-law losing his job at Youngstown Sheet and Tube off for 13 months and had to roof houses and, just to get by. Or I could tell you a story 15 or 20 years ago of a cousin of mine who's a Vietnam veteran who had to unbolt the machine from the factory floor and ship it to China right before he lost his job. And then many people are familiar with the General Motors plant just outside of Youngstown, Ohio, that just closed down a few weeks ago. I mean, it was at 16,000 people at one point, and now it's closed. And what differentiates me is when that factory closed or those things happen, I know who the people are. They're my family. They're my friends. They know my wife is friends with them. My wife teaches school. She's a first grade school teacher. The kids go to her school. My daughter, who's 15, called me crying that her friend was crying at school all day because her dad lost his job and they're going to have to move and she's going to be out of school. I mean, we know this. And I think the most important thing for the Democrats to do is send someone as our nominee and to make the next president somebody who deeply, deeply understands the struggles and the pain and the adversity that the working class and the working poor are going through today.
Mm-hmm. We're talking to Ohio Congressman Tim Ryan, who's running for president in 2020. I'd love to jump right into the issues now, Congressman. You and President Trump both agree that China poses a significant competitive threat to American industries. And you told PBS's NewsHour Judy Woodruff that tariffs are an important tactic to use when negotiating with China as part of a larger strategy. Do you support the president's use of tariffs to try to push China toward a better trade deal?
I do support the use of tariffs. I do not support. I mean, the president has the problem right, but he has no clue as to what he's doing to actually fix it. Using tariffs in targeted ways, which are legal through international law, if a country's dumping steel or dumping a product, we should have a way to put on countervailing duties or use anti-dumping provisions. I think that's entirely appropriate. The problem with the president is there's no broader strategy, as you said, and you know they're beating us badly at electric vehicles, for example. They control 40 to 50% of that market. China dominates 60% of the solar panel market. China's running circles around us with fifth-generation internet. If we're going to put our head in the sand and pretend that's not a problem, we're not doing our country or our kids or our economy any favors. And so we have to take them on, but you do that by having an industrial policy in the United States. Yeah, you are firm with them. You make sure they don't cheat. You make sure they, best you can, don't steal intellectual property. But at the end of the day, you got to outcompete them. And what does that mean? That means investments in education, investments in healthcare, investments in our community, making sure we move to the green economy and the economy of the future, and then cut workers in on the deal. So we're rebuilding the middle class while we're rebuilding our economy. That's how you beat China.
So, listeners, we're talking to Ohio Congressman Tim Ryan, and we'd like to know what questions you have for him. Give us a call. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Let's talk about this industrial plan, this industrial strategy, Congressman. I think it's safe to say that reversing the trend of deindustrialization in this country seems to be the driving theme of your campaign. So how do we reindustrialize? How do we stay competitive and support American industries struggling to keep up with China using the kind of statistics you just noted?
Well, some of the things that I'm going to do, one is I'll have a chief manufacturing officer that's working directly for me as president that will help us create this industrial policy. And then say, for example, the president drives it and drives the policy to say, okay, how do we dominate 50% of the electric vehicle market in the next 5 years? And you bring in the Department of Energy, Department of Transportation, venture capital, big three, emerging electric vehicle companies. And you say, what do we, Small Business Administration, what do we have to do to win this? And you put a plan together and you win it. And then you do the same thing with solar, Department of Energy, National Science Foundation. Who do we need involved, both public and private sectors, research institutions? And then how do we dominate it? And then my goal is, how do you steer that growth? You know, like I told you about 30 million electric vehicles in the next 10 years are going to be made somewhere in the world. We want them made in the United States. Solar's growing at 30%, wind's growing at 20%. So how do we dominate these industries and then steer the growth to the communities that have been left behind, communities of color, old coal, old steel, old auto, old rubber, making sure that this new growth is happening in those communities. And this is the industrial plan, and it's got to be done from 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, or it's not going to get done. And if it makes sense to any of your listeners, they can go to timryanforamerica.com and support my campaign and support me to get on the debate stage and everything else by sending $5 or $10, whatever the deal is today.
Well, let's...
But they will see on my website the initiatives that we're putting forth that are going to transform the country.
So let's talk to one of our listeners. Jim's calling from Roxbury to talk to you. Welcome, Jim. What's on your mind for the congressman?
I was wondering what the congressman is going to do if he's elected president about American terrorists.
Okay, Jim, thanks for that call. Congressman Ryan, what's your position on terrorism?
Well, you know, we're going to prosecute them. We're going to prosecute the terrorists. I think we do have to have an aggressive policy where we are making sure we do protect the border and we know who's coming in and out of our country. But at the end of the day, you know, that's got to be done. I mean, I think we've got to have a policy, an immigration policy that both is compassionate but also secures our borders and makes sure that terrorists aren't getting in the country. And also make sure that the drugs aren't getting in the country. I represent Ohio. We have a huge opiate epidemic in Ohio, and I want to make sure that those drugs aren't coming in either. So you have to have a firm policy on security, but you can do that and have a compassionate and economically viable immigration plan.
So you've said you can't come to Ohio and the Great Lakes states and assure them about immigration without first and foremost assuring people that you're going to protect their children. So what do you mean? How are immigrants threatening the children of the people in Ohio?
Well, no, just I think making sure that people understand that you take seriously keeping bad people out of the country, that you take seriously as president of the United States, that you don't want drugs into the country. And once you assure people of that, people are compassionate, people are reasonable. If you make sure they know that you're going to take care of the security piece, then you promote the compassionate comprehensive immigration reform, a pathway to citizenship, take care of our DACA kids, make the argument that we want to keep a lot of these innovators who are going to our universities, are going to create jobs. We don't want them to get a PhD at Carnegie Mellon in Pittsburgh or Case Western Reserve in Cleveland, and they're prepared and ready to start a company that's going to be worth hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars. And we tell them to go back to their home country and create those jobs there. We want those folks to be in the United States. This is a country of diversity. My family immigrated here from Italy not so far back, and Ireland even further back. But this is a country where we want to appreciate that. But you got to make sure people know as president that you're going to make this a secure country as well.
Okay, Congressman, I'm going to take another caller in a second. But first, listeners, please keep calling. What are your questions for Ohio Congressman Tim Ryan? The number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Victoria from Gloucester has called in. Victoria, what's on your mind?
Hi. I think one of the biggest issues facing the country these days is division. We really, really need a leader who's going to help unify us. And while I applaud Congressman Ryan's concern about working people, which I'm very concerned about, I live in a coastal town full of working people, fishermen, who are really suffering. So I was very dismayed to hear him bashing coastal elites as though everybody who lives on the coast is elite. And that kind of talk is not unifying. So I'm just curious what he intends to do to help unify this country.
Congressman, yeah, she kind of gotcha on that one.
Yeah,
so
no,
what
no,
is your
I'm,
unifying
no, I'm
message?
I'm really glad you called in, and I'm really glad you said that, because I'm saying the perception from people in the Midwest is that our communities are falling apart, and that you see the big centers. You see Boston, you see San Francisco, you see Austin, you see New York. And from the vantage point of the average person, you see venture capital, where 80% of it only goes to three states, California, Massachusetts, and New York. I've been trying to say myself is that this problem is everywhere. You mentioned the fishermen. We could talk about farm workers. We could talk about coastal communities. We can talk about tent cities in L.A., where the homeless crisis is of epic proportions, where families are literally living in tent cities in L.A. And I use that example all the time because I do say, look, from our vantage point, it looks like everybody in L.A. is doing great, but really they're not. And so my point is we've got to all come together, urban, rural, north, south, men, women, black, white, brown, gay, straight, working people from all over the country have to come together. And I think the perception of the Democratic Party is that we don't address the real needs of the working class, and that we have to get back to addressing those needs. It needs to be front and center, whether it's true or not. That's the perception. And I appreciate you bringing it up, because that's not how I feel at all, because I see those people. I meet with them. I hear them. They're having the same struggles. In fact, I was in Boston the other day, and I had a young woman come up to me, and she was appreciative I was talking about the working class, because she's working in Boston in retail, and she doesn't feel like she's getting treated fairly. She's got a master's degree, and she's not getting paid enough. She can't find affordable housing, which is a huge issue all across the country. These are all of our problems.
So
and even the top 1%. These are American problems.
So let's take a call. Let's take another call. Noah from Lexington is on the line. Noah, what's your question for the congressman?
Hi, Congressman. So my name's Noah, and I'm a high school student. So something that's been on my mind for a really long time is the topic of gun control, with all of these school shootings that have been really going on so massively throughout our country. So I was wondering what you plan to do about gun control and gun reform, and if that's really on your agenda at all.
Thanks for that call, Noah. Congressman, you are a recreational hunter who previously had an A rating from the NRIA, but you've changed your mind over time. And in 2017, you took the money the NRA had given you and donated it to organizations that were advocating for stricter gun laws. So where are you on gun control now?
I'm all for it. I support a background, universal background check. I support the ban on making sure weapons of war don't get into our streets. I support studying gun violence as a public health issue through the Center for Disease Control. I support closing the Charleston loophole in making sure that, you know, people can't get guns even if the 3-day waiting period has gone away, even though you don't have an answer. So I'm for all of those. And I would say I would like us to start playing offense on this issue. If you look at 90% of the kids or the people who do the school shootings, and this is very personal too, because we have three kids in school, and my wife is a first grade school teacher, and Brady, who's five, is right down the hall from my wife. And I think you prevent this by the understanding that 90% of the kids who do this come from the school that the incident happens in. And so over 70% of those kids have felt shamed, have felt abused, have felt bullied by people in that school. And so one of the things I'm promoting as part of my education agenda is social and emotional learning and trauma-based care in the schools. And these programs help connect kids to each other, help kids deal with their trauma, a lot of the mental health issues that are out there, and connect them to the school, to the teacher, and everyone else. And when you see what they studied up at Sandy Hook, they came back with three recommendations on how to prevent gun violence from happening in the schools again. One was the gun issue, gun control. Second was mental health. And the third was put social and emotional learning in the school. That's okay. How you play offense on that.
Congressman, thanks for that. Listen, we have very limited time, but several people have called in asking me to push back a little bit more on your question about terrorism. What would you do about homegrown terrorism? And just very quickly.
In what way?
Well, so what are the preventive measures for domestic terrorism? You talked sort of internationally before. How do you think about homegrown terrorism?
Well, I mean, a lot of this, I think these racial crimes are homegrown terrorism, and I think they should be treated as such. I think that the level of discrimination now that's been incited by the President of the United States should be treated as American terrorists. There's no question about it. And so they should be treated the same. And, you know, obviously you've got to have law enforcement and investigations and keeping an eye on these folks and keeping them away from weapons and other things that would allow them to do damage. But the level of racism from the KKK and these other places should definitely be treated as domestic terrorism.
Yeah, there is so much more we could have talked about, but I do appreciate you coming in. That's Ohio Congressman Tim Ryan. He's running for president in 2020. Congressman Ryan, thanks for being with us on Radio Boston.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Jamie Bologna, Zoe Mitchell, Chris Siderick, Paris Alston, and Walter Wuthman. Tim Skog is our technical director. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Tiziana Deering. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.
Wait, don't go yet.
Because you already know how to download a podcast.
But if you have any other tech or life question, maybe we can help you. WBUR is working on a new show, and we need your tech questions.
Or maybe your parents' questions. Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and leave a message. 617-917-4717.
Yes, we know. How quaint. A phone call. But give it a try. 617-917-4717.